another American Bankruptcy Institute podcast. I'm David Skeel, the scholar in residence at the ABI. With me today is Judge Thomas Ambrose, formerly a leading commercial and bankruptcy lawyer and now a federal judge on the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. A graduate of the Georgetown University Law Center, Judge Ambrose worked on the staff of U.S. Senator Bill Ross and clerked on the Delaware Supreme Court before beginning a distinguished career in private practice. He was a partner for many years at the Wilmington, Delaware law firm Richards, Layton & Finger before joining the bench on the Third Circuit in the year 2000. Judge Ambrose, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, David.
I thought I would begin sort of at the beginning, just talking a little bit about your years in practice. Could you talk a little bit about your practice and in particular how you wound up in the world of bankruptcy? My understanding is you didn't start there.
Well, I started there and then didn't start there. My first day at Richards, Layton & Finger in 1976 in July, I was asked by Norm Veazey, who was later Delaware Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but then was managing partner at Richards, Layton. He said, "Do you know anything about bankruptcy?" And I said, "Yeah. Yeah, if a guy can't pay his debts, he goes bankrupt." And I laughed, and he didn't. And so I got assigned to a bankruptcy case at Town Enterprises, worked on that for essentially a couple of months. And then after that, I was assigned to a commercial transactional practice with a fellow by the name of Marty Lubaroff, who subsequently became a good friend. But at the time, I thought I was being hired to do litigation. And so I went back in to Norm Veazey, and I remember saying, "Mr. Veazey," and he goes, "Call me Norm." I says, "Mr. Norm, I thought I was hired here to do litigation, and I understand that I'm assigned to Marty Lubaroff, and I just want to let you know that I took in law school a UCC course, pass-fail, and I dropped it for lack of interest." And he said, "Give it a shot." And so those are some of the twists and turns in people's professional roads. And that's how I ended up in the commercial transactional area. I later headed up the UCC commercial law section for two or three years. And then for about 20 years was the head of the Uniform Commercial Code Subcommittee of the commercial law section of the Delaware State Bar Association. So the point being that you go into things and you have no idea sometimes how they're going to end up. What I did do, however, because I did wish to do litigation, is in the 70s and 80s, to the extent I could get into something that was litigation. I had one commercial case that went into trial. I worked on that with one of my former partner, Max Bell. I was an associate at that time. He was a partner. I would do appellate work to the extent I could, primarily with Delaware Supreme Court. I would do workman's comp, believe it or not. I actually kind of enjoyed it, and it got me into court. And I would dabble in bankruptcy as much as I could. The only problem was that the Bankruptcy Act that I started with in 1976 became the Bankruptcy Code in the late 70s, and so there was a whole new area of bankruptcy law to learn. Later, what happened in my case, and I can tell you the exact date, it was December 3, 1990, Continental filed, Continental Airlines. And I got a call, it's on a Monday morning, about 10:45 or so, and 10:50, because I remember looking at my watch for reasons I'll note in a second. And it was Mike Siegel with someone else. Mike Siegel is a dear friend of mine. He was then a partner at Simpson Thatcher in New York. And he called and said Continental had filed and that they were representing aircraft financiers. And he kept saying 1110, 1110. And he was talking so fast, even though Mike's originally from Macon, Georgia, that's when I looked at my watch. And I said, "No, it's 10 of 11 to myself. What's he saying, 1110? And so that was the beginning. And then in Continental, there was a group of about 60 aircraft financiers that our firm represented. And when it came time to argue before the district court on appeal, from an adverse decision as to whether this particular provision applied to the aircraft financiers. I was nominated to do the argument to the district court and ultimately to the Third Circuit. And so I was sort of back in it, and I thought, this is interesting. I have a really interesting, fun, transactional deal practice. But nonetheless, at the time I was saying to myself, okay, well, let's just get somebody else involved and I'll stay with my transactional work and et cetera. But what happened was there was really nobody in the firm at the time that wanted to get involved. So ultimately I did, and we just started growing the bankruptcy group within the firm to was myself and then a couple of other lawyers, and then we ultimately expanded to the, by the time I left, we had about 11, 12 lawyers. They now have more than that, and the equal number of paralegals. And it was at age 41, I was off to doing, in effect, what I was asked to do at the very beginning of 1976. And I must say, at times it was scary, because I would be going off to court and I would be saying to myself, geez, these folks really know this stuff. I'm learning it on the fly. They're professionals in this area. I'm not. And I wonder if I can walk on water today or if I'm just going to fall in and drown. But you later learn.
And your Third Circuit argument in the original Continental case, which of those did that feel like? Did it feel like the drowning or the walking on water or something in between?
I was lucky enough to argue before the D.C. Court, U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit when I was 24, 25, two cases. I loved it. And this was, even though there was an interim of about 15 or 16 years going back to my last oral argument before a U.S. Court of Appeals, that to me is what I always wanted to do. I think appellate practice is about as good as it gets, and it was fun. If you're prepared, you can stand up there and you can say, no matter what, I know this subject, and I'm here to answer any questions that you may have. I can remember in the Third Circuit case, I was arguing before Judge Ed Becker, who Judge Tony Sirica and Judge Walt Stapleton, all three of whom subsequently became and still are, except for Eddie's case because Eddie died, very close friends. And
that is certainly an absolute all-star cast of judges.
And
as well.
I can remember Eddie Becker walking out and saying to the clerks, well, let's keep the time on this one. Let's stay to the time. Well, of course, Eddie never did that. When your red light went on, you were on his time. And we went on for about an hour and 15, an hour and 20 minutes. And I remember standing up. I normally, when I had oral arguments before an appellate court, I would have just three sheets of paper. One is a very brief outline. Two is a list of what I perceive will be tough questions, and just to make sure that I have something to start off on. It's just very cryptically done. And the third is a list of key cases and just a couple of words about those cases, again, just to trigger thoughts. Even with that scant amount of material, when I went up to argue in this case, it was clear to me that they were going to, it was a very hot panel. And I can remember putting the three pieces of paper down to the side, taking out a pen, and saying that while it's been a long time since I've done a leveraged lease of an airplane, let's pretend that this pen is an airplane, and here's how you do a leverage lease of an airplane in the context of Section 1110 of the Bankruptcy Code. It just went on from there. But when I walked out of the D.C. Circuit, my first oral argument in, again, 74, 75, I remember saying to myself, this is what I want to do. And so now I'm doing it on the other side and loving it.
Just a moment more on the circuit court arguments. What were the arguments in law school that you referred to?
It was a in Georgetown. University Law Center, there was an appellate litigation clinic. And they would take appeals on behalf, usually in prisoner cases, to the D.C. Circuit, later on to the Fourth Circuit as well. And there was a student practice rule that was put into effect under the D.C. Circuit rules. And my very first oral argument was before Chief Judge David Bazelon, Judge Skelly Wright, and Judge, I believe, Rob.
Wow.
Another all-star cast. And I got up there and I thought, you know, this just makes all the synapses in the brain work. And it was exhilarating. It's challenging. I'm not saying beforehand you're not nervous. You clearly are. If you're not, there's something wrong with you. I guess Chief Justice Roberts said it best when he was in private practice and he had 39 Supreme Court arguments and many more Court of Appeals arguments. You know, you would be just, you know, not sleeping well beforehand. The Chief said oftentimes he would in private practice, he might have a flu or a cold about 10 days before. And the morning of, you would say to yourself, why in the world am I doing this? I mean, there's other people out there enjoying themselves. This is no way to make a living. This is such stress. And then after the oral argument, you walk out and you say to yourself, when's the next one? And this is great. And that's, you know, in the appellate world, that's sort of, I think, the same type of feeling that litigators have. Some of the instincts that at first attracted me to wanting to do litigation are just that.
You said that Continental was kind of your re-entry full-time into the world of bankruptcy. Continental is often thought of, I believe, accurately, as the case that really put Delaware on the bankruptcy map. So in a sense, the rise of your bankruptcy practice paralleled the rise of Delaware, which, as most of our listeners will know, has been controversial in many quarters. Mm-hmm. Were you involved in the controversies at all, or were you involved in kind of explaining Delaware to the world in the 1990s?
The last statement describes it. After Continental filed, there were a host of mega bankruptcies that were filed. TWA, Columbia Gas, I think Columbia Gas might have been even before TWA, and just many, many after that, to the point where in the 1990s, Delaware became the principal forum for mega cases filing. I think the principal forum is back, reverted back now to the Southern District of New York, the Bankruptcy Court for the Southern District of New York. But we got word in around the mid-1990s that in conjunction with the putting together of a National Bankruptcy Review Commission, that there was an effort being made to have the commission recommend that the venue statute for bankruptcies be changed. It currently, and as it did then, said that you could file where you have your principal place of business, your principal assets, or you are organized. And because so many corporations and now LLCs are organized or in Delaware, Delaware was a proper venue under the statute. Many cases filed, and there was a backlash toward Delaware. And I was at that point involved, along with Alicia Rani Marinelli and other people, in writing. Alicia did by far the lion's share of the work in terms of putting forward the case for why the venue statute should not be changed. And in the end, Delaware really had and still has to this day to thank our congressional delegation and especially Senator Biden for the work that they have done in connection with that particular effort. But clearly in the 90s, it was a very hot topic. It's still a hot topic today with a lot of the articles that, David, you yourself have written and Lynn Lopucky's written and others, and you and Lynn are on different sides. But the it's one that has legs, as they say, and I don't think we've heard the last word on that topic.
So you've kind of anticipated my next question, which is, you referred earlier to the fact that the Southern District of New York appears to have become the principal or the venue of choice for the very biggest cases again. You don't think that will diffuse the controversy? Will it just shift the controversy a bit?
That I don't know. I think it's it may be that if there is a movement afoot that continues, that it may attempt to deal with both Delaware in terms of venue and possibly also the Southern District of New York as well. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see how it plays out. But the interesting thing throughout all of this, the bankruptcy judges here, if a case was perceived by those judges or any judge as not belonging here, the judge sometimes would even invite a motion to transfer venue. As you know, you can't do it sua sponte,
right,
as a bankruptcy judge or a district court judge. But the judges here have been all too willing to, I don't mean all too willing in the negative sense, I mean, but quite willing to transfer a case that doesn't belong. But in any event, the issue was joined in the mid-90s. There was a proposal made that ultimately carried through the National Bankruptcy Review Commission. It was not enacted into law so far, but as I said, the topic remains one that there is a lot of discussion about.
Shifting back to your work on the court, as you were making the transition to becoming a Third Circuit judge, were there any particular role models who you kind of thought of as sources of guidance for what being a judge is all about?
Well, there are probably a number. Clearly, my first boss, I clerked for Chief Justice Daniel Herman, the Delaware Supreme Court, and he was just a wonderful person. And I had a great year with him. In addition, Judge Colin Seitz in this state, Delaware, is a hero. He's considered by many to be maybe the finest example of a really great group of judges in the 20th century. He was chancellor or vice chancellor from 1946 to 66. Judge Seitz, or Chancellor Seitz at that time, then he won the Third Circuit, and he was there about 32 years. But as Chancellor Seitz, Collins was the first judge in America to integrate a public school system, and indeed the only decisions that were affirmed in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954 were the two combined cases from Delaware that Collins had decided in 1952. But where I first knew of him was in law school. He was the judge whose opinions you read in corporate law textbooks, and the Battershue, I could go on, just a host of others.
Yeah, they're still in those textbooks.
And they're still in the textbooks, and he was just a truly gifted corporate jurist, and it was just sort of like that duck took to that water so well. On the Third Circuit, he, among other things, he was chief judge for 13 years, and he was known especially for his innovations with regard to federal appellate practice, and was just an outstanding chief judge for the court, just outstanding. And I don't know of a single human being, I've never talked with anyone, who disliked Colin Seitz. He led without being confrontational or like that. But he was not averse to making decisions when he had to make them. He was a great administrator, a great judge, and a great human being. So Dan Herman and the Collin Sites. I was lucky enough in the first year and a half when I sat on the Third Circuit, I was in Collin Sites' old chambers, which are now part of the library. And I sat, I guess, about 18 inches or so away from where Collin sat. And every now and then on a tough case, I'd look up and say, okay, Collins, now what would you do on this one? But I have in my conference room, my clerks gave me a plaque of various stories relating to Collin Sites. A hero, quite simply a hero.
Yeah, he really was a remarkable man and a remarkable judge. As a bankruptcy expert coming on to the circuit court, do you feel a particular responsibility when y'all get bankruptcy cases or have bankruptcy cases seemed just like other cases?
No, they never do. My areas obviously were commercial practice and bankruptcy. And so if I get a commercial practice case, maybe a contract case or certainly a UCC case or a bankruptcy case, UCC, you do have a internal feeling that, boy, I better make sure I get this right. And I think in bankruptcy, for example, I'm sure that Mitch Rendell, one of my colleagues, feels the same way. They're not assigned to you. It's done by wheel. So if you get a bankruptcy case, it's because in your list, we have six sittings a year, in your roughly 40 cases in that sitting, there is a bankruptcy case that comes to you. But you do feel a special responsibility for those cases because it's how you made your professional living as a lawyer prior to going on the bench.
Pause this week's podcast to bring you bankruptcy in the news. As federal legislation passed last week reforming private pensions, news this week focused on possible reforms to address public pension funding shortfalls. The New York Times reported on Tuesday that a number of states, counties, and municipalities are examining potential pension shortfalls, estimated by some at $375 billion. Barclays Global Investments calculated that if state pension plans were required to use the same rules as corporations, the total value of the benefits they have promised would be an estimated $2.5 trillion, but they currently are only funded up to $1.7 trillion. While the National Association of State Retirement Administrators says it is unrealistic to expect all public plans to be fully funded, Congress's Government Accountability Office announced that it was looking for ways to tighten the rules for public pensions. Public pensions first came under scrutiny in 2003 when a San Diego pension trustee whistleblower forced the city to reveal that it had underfunded its public pensions for years. This set off a wave of lawsuits, investigations, and eventually criminal indictments. Estimates of San Diego's public pension deficit currently show a $1.4 billion shortfall. Investigators looking into San Diego's pension crisis, led by former Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Arthur Levitt Jr., recommended Tuesday that San Diego strengthen its internal financial controls and that a permanent audit committee be established to provide continuous independent oversight. This has been John Hartgen of the ABI. Thank you for listening, and now back to this week's podcast.
The past several years, you have kind of, apropos of what you've just been saying about the role you might play in some of these cases, you've authored two of the most important recent bankruptcy decisions. I'm referring, as many readers may also not need to be given names, but I'm referring to the Owens Corning decision, which dealt with a substantive consolidation issue, and a more recent case called Cytex, which addressed the so-called deepening insolvency doctrine. So I was hoping I could ask you a couple of questions about these cases. I'm particularly interested in the way you wrote these two decisions. One of the things that struck me about the Owens Corning case, the substantive consolidation case, it's a hugely important case for the test it adopts for substantive consolidation. But one of the things that struck me most about the case is the amount of historical analysis that you put into it, the depth of your reading and writing into the history of substantive consolidation, and also the fact that you cite and use several law review articles in the course of your analysis. Was there a particular reason why you provided such a detailed historical analysis?
In Owens Corning, it's interesting. There, I used to do the, or be in charge of doing the substantive non-consolidation opinions at Richards, Leighton & Finger. And there was a dearth of case law in the Third Circuit or even in district courts within the Third Circuit. And so it's an issue I'd been thinking about a lot since 1991, although I used to say to myself, boy, it would be great to be a judge and write on this area. The funny thing is, I wasn't sure exactly what I would write. And when I got such a case, the first thing that hit me was, geez, there's a lot of stuff here I thought I knew, but I don't, or I'm not sure. So I decided it was worth going back and doing a real education for myself as to how we got here. And I was a history major in college, and I thought, you know, there are articles out there that say that so often, and there's a famous one that was done in 1965 by, a non-lawyer by the name of Alfred Kelly, saying that lawyers in writing briefs and judges in their opinions veer into what is known as law office history, which is you selectively choose facts that support your position. And I thought, well, this topic has been kicking around now for more than six decades. There is a real difference of how courts analyze the issue. Might we be able to go back, say, what happened at the outset? And then so many cases gave factors that you considered, and the factors didn't add up for me. I mean, some cases had seven factors, some had 20, some, et cetera, and it didn't make sense. There were actually three things that really were extremely helpful. The first thing as to why we went the way we did, a group of law professors, and I think, David, you were one of them, although I believe it was led by Robert Rasmussen from Vanderbilt, that said, you know, when you look at these concepts as to when you take separate entities and combine them for the purposes of combining assets and liabilities and, in effect, ignoring legal boundaries. When you do that, what are some of the policies that you would look to? And I just changed the word policies to principles. What are some of the principles that we can glean from that after going through a history? And I spent a lot of time on and came up with five principles that seemed to fit based on the cases. The second thing was, but going back to the beginning, I found an article by a person by the name of Mary Elizabeth Kors, or Mary Beth Kors, K-O-R-S, that was extremely helpful. It was written in the University of Pittsburgh Law Review in 1998. And then I also found an article that challenged whether substantive consolidation after the enactment of the bankruptcy code should even be considered a viable option any longer. And that was by Maxwell Tucker. Maxwell Tucker, and it was both articles were very well done. And for the history, I found that Coors article was quite helpful. And there's a long footnote in Owens Corning that deals with Max Tucker's article as to what I perceived the answers would be to that. And with those three items in mind, I then began the process. My problem with the whole case was that it was argued in February. It was assigned to me the day of argument. And come May, I hadn't done anything on it. I kept trying to clear the decks of other cases and at other sittings. And finally, I sat down in a hotel room in Utah where I was out there for meetings and just went only to the meetings I had to go to and began the process of really digging in. And I sort of finished up in a hotel room in August in Chicago. And the perception that I started off with and at the end I felt we had to do was, how did we get here? Because once you got past the history, you had diverging paths. Primarily, there was a Second Circuit case written by Judge Ralph Winter about 19, 20 years ago called In Re Augie Restivo. And that took one path. And then another path of analysis was that of a case from the same year, roughly, In Re Auto Train out of the D.C. Circuit, and which made more sense in terms of a way to analytically look at the issues pertaining to substantive consolidation. So that's why the lengthy opinion there. As to Cydex, the issue there was whether a case about 4 or 5 years ago called Lafferty, is there a cause of action for, quote, deepening insolvency, close quote, under Pennsylvania law? And that particular panel concluded on behalf of the court that there was. A host of issues have come up since then. Does deepening insolvency, is it a cause of action only? Can that cause of action, is it only for fraud, which is what you had in Lafferty? Or could it be extended to negligent conduct, which was what was alleged in Cytex? Was it a theory of damages, et cetera? Because the issue was only a few years old, and because it appeared, in thinking about it, that the best thing we could do, and people may disagree with this, obviously, the best thing we can do is just to be simple and direct, very simple, as short as we can be in dealing with these issues. And it wasn't perceived, again, perhaps incorrectly, that we needed to go back into the history of Pennsylvania law. Again, this dealt with Pennsylvania law. So that's sort of the superficial thinking, I guess, that went into why one was long and the other was short.
Is that generalizable to the way you write opinions across the board, that that you'll use history in some cases where it seems like there may be a historical confusion or something to be gained from the history, whereas in other cases...
Usually when you go into the history, it's got to be an area that has been unsettled for a lengthy period of time. I'll give you one example. Ed Becker, in a bank case called Cybergenics, wrote an opinion that went into a lot of the history of the particular issue that was involved in that case. And so it's one that normally you state the issue, you state what the precedent is, and you go on. It's the infrequent case where you have to go, perhaps the rare case, where you really go deeply into the history of a particular topic.
switching to the other side of the fence in these bankruptcy appeal cases, now obviously you are seeing the bankruptcy lawyers and commercial lawyers you practiced with from opposite sides of the table. Do you have any particular advice for bankruptcy and commercial lawyers when they're bringing appeals, or are there particular things they do in appellate arguments that are a mistake or that they should do differently?
Any advice that I would give wouldn't be limited to just bankruptcy practitioners. I think it applies across the board. Regardless whether you're in the United States Supreme Court or JP Court, a lot of your effectiveness as an advocate depends on your credibility. And in addition to having credibility, that is being trusted by the court that what you say, while you're an advocate, nonetheless is not going to mislead the particular deciding person or group of people. That it's also, they perceive that you are competent. So I call it connecting with credibility. You connect with your competence and your credibility aids you in being trusted by the parties before whom you are speaking about a case or pleading a case or advocating a case. And the credibility is maybe the best way to give an example is Lou Holtz, the football coach, says when you meet someone, whether you are entering into a casual conversation or at some point you are considering entering into the most intimate of relationships, you instinctively ask yourself three questions. Can I trust you? Do you care about me? And will you do the right thing? If the answer to all three is yes, then you've got yourself somebody who's a true friend. In the case of judges, they're asking themselves the same type of question of the advocates who appear before them. Can I trust what you say? Do you care that we're trying to get it right here? And when push comes to shove, will you do the right thing? And the ones who you can unequivocally answer yes to that question, they are effective. If you lose your credibility, not only do you hurt yourself, not only do you hurt your client in the case that's before you, but you hurt future clients down the road because while the case may be good, the person making that case, you no longer have the same amount of trust as you did before, and you've got to work your way through that so that you don't let that in any way affect your decision. But effective advocates are trusted. Back at my old law firm, they used to have a story about Aaron Finger, the Finger and Richards Leighton Finger. Aaron Finger could take a 15-page brief with three or four issues and make it three pages with one issue. And you go, why are you doing that, Mr. Finger? Or somebody, Marty Lubroff was telling me this story years ago. And Mr. Finger said, because this is the one issue they care about. And the court would look at it and they'd say, if Aaron Finger says this is the one issue we should care about, this is the one issue we should care about. That's connecting because of his great talent, but also he had credibility. They trusted that what he said was the right way to go in terms of analyzing the issue. And that's what makes for effective attorneys.
One last question, I think, and that is, do you still have ties to the bankruptcy bar? Do you still see some of your former partners and colleagues in the bar regularly, or once you become a judge, is all that past?
It's not all past. I don't see my law firm, I don't see them very often. They're only a block away. Where I do see is a lot of the younger lawyers in the firms around town, because I've been involved in the, actually, interestingly enough, Colin Seitz Bankruptcy Inn of Court. So it's the American Bankruptcy Inns of Court, a chapter, one of the chapters in Delaware relates to bankruptcy, and I'm co-chair currently in that inn with Judge Mary Walrath of the Bankruptcy Court. And so I do stay involved a bit in that. I do get involved in various seminars that I've done, or not seminars, or, you know, programs dealing with bankruptcy. There was a recent one done in Delaware on June 9th by the American Bankruptcy Institute. I've done stuff with the NYU Advanced Reorganization programs that they've done up there. They just keep you up to speed. I've done a number of moot courts, including the Connie Duberstein moot court competition for bankruptcy law that's done through St. John's Law School, and the arguments are at the Second Circuit. And it's always fun to sit in the same, roughly the same area where Judges Learned Hand and Augustus Hand and Tom Swan and Henry Friendly and others sat.
Many of whom, just to keep this on the topic of bankruptcy, were particular bankruptcy experts. Certainly Henry Friendly was one of the great bankruptcy judges of the century.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And interesting story. I don't know if I think you may have recently interviewed Harvey Miller. Harvey used to tell me that when he argued before Judge Friendly, I mean, there was no one. He knew that Judge Friendly knew the topic, the area backward and forward. And you knew that if you had a bankruptcy case before Judge Friendly, you were going to be grilled. And if you stood up to that, you were quite good.
I cannot even imagine it. Well, Judge Ambrose, thank you so much for joining us. This has been incredibly informative, and it's just a joy to talk to you as always.
Well, same here, David. And if there's anything else you need, just let me know.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to one of a series of podcasts that we are producing here at the American Bankruptcy Institute to help us all understand better how bankruptcy professionals do their work. We hope you found it helpful. Look on our webpage at abiworld.org for more podcast choices. This is Jack here saying thank you for listening.